Even academicians and intellectuals are talking as if there's no such thing as truth. Whereas in daily life, they wouldn't function like that. What they say in the classroom is one thing. If they go out of the classroom and they get hit by a car or they fall very sick, then they won't start indulging in post-truth relativism. They'll either go to a doctor or pray or do something about it on the ground that this has actually happened. You can't do without truth in your daily life. If you have a headache, you take a pill or you pray to Jesus, whatever you want to do, but you don't say, I don't have a headache. It's all a dream. So this illusion that everything is a dream and everything is an illusion, this is false. Because in order to say that everything is an illusion, in order to say that everybody is asleep, at least one person must be awake to notice that everybody else is asleep.
This is the podcast to restore your faith in humanity. In this podcast, we are interviewing men and women whom we call Chilean giraffes, courageous, tireless workers for the greater good. May each of them inspire you to follow in their tracks and contribute your own part to a just society and a healthy environment. Welcome to another episode of the podcast to restore your faith in humanity. Today we welcome Dilip Simeon, who is a well-known labor historian and novelist in India. Dilip Simeon is an expert on the life and teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. The inspiration Gandhi gives him is not only intellectual, since he has led hunger strikes himself in order to denounce injustice. On Gandhi, he recently said, "Gandhi is a very controversial figure, and he remains controversial. When he was on his last hunger fast in January 1948, people shouted for him to die. It is a matter of interest that even those who hate him somehow need to own him, and they sanitize him, they neutralize him, domesticate him, and own him in a curious manner. Recently, people were hailing his assassins." Welcome, Dilip Simeon, to our podcast.
Thank you, Dimi.
How is it possible that today in India, some people are worshipping both Gandhi and his assassins? How is that possible?
You see, the fact is that he is very well known and popular on a world stage. In fact, he's not simply an Indian statesman. As I have argued, you know, there are some people whose greatness goes beyond their national origins or their culture and linguistic origins. He's one of those. So keeping in mind that popularity that he enjoys, those who hate him also somehow, if they are in power, try to mute that and mask that by domesticating him in some way. Now they've made him domesticated him by making him a champion of cleanliness and public cleanliness and so on. But he was did not confine his observations to being clean. So there is a political reason why people need to hide their hatred of him. They do that by making out a great deal of admiration for him on the world stage. But at the local level, you come across all the waves of hatred on social media and so on. So there's a lot of propaganda. Mm-hmm. I think that is something I've dealt with in my talk also, which you have heard and cited. So you don't need to spend too much time on that.
No, you often talk about Gandhi. And in a recent address to the Gandhi Peace Foundation, you said that Gandhi's idea about evil was that it's merely the parasite of good. Now, what did he mean to tell us there? Why is that so important to you?
I always found it a fascinating statement philosophically. It's a statement which is loaded, philosophically loaded, with moral philosophy. The exact statement is that good is self-existent, evil is not. It is a parasite that lives in and around good. It will collapse of its own accord once the support given to it by good is withdrawn. These three sentences are very loaded with moral philosophy. In fact, they're philosophical sentences. It's not simply a question of moral philosophy. It's a question of philosophy per se. And you find this kind of observation across the board. You'll find it in Plato, in the Republic, where he where Socratic dialogue about the good. It's very clear that good precedes even justice and beauty. Good is above all, you know. You find this in Hannah Arendt, who said, evil is not radical. It lacks depth. It only has extremity. It's only extreme. So evil spreads like a fungus over the surface, but it doesn't have any depth. Only the good has depth. So philosophically, the question of the good, what is good and the good, and these are questions which are very, very heavy, and people and thinking people and religious people have thought about these questions for centuries. It's not just that Gandhi thought about it. I began to think more about this issue. For me, this sentence of Gandhi has always been fascinating, because he uttered it at a time when he had sat on his penultimate hunger fast, which was in Calcutta in 1947. His last fast was the one after which he was murdered. But just before that, he had gone on a fast in Calcutta to prevent the possibility of violence, which had already begun in the middle of independence. So towards the end of August, he sat on a fast. In mid-August, he was in Calcutta. Everybody was celebrating independence. But he said, this is not going to last. And sure enough, more violence began in Calcutta towards the end, August 31. And he went on fast for 3 days. I think it was beginning of September, 1st of September. And it's a very moving story. I can't quote all of it to you. At some point, I
can. No, but parts of that are in the fantastic movie about Gandhi's life, exactly. And where you see that his enemies even come to his bed and
it's not that they were his enemies. They were the hooligans who were engaging in communal killings. They were not his enemies. They were going around killing people. So he went on fast. And he said that I will, this is the only thing I can do. And within a day or two, it began to have an impact all over the city. Left-wing students said, we support him. Even the British Englishmen and Anglo-Indian police officers, they wore black armbands on their uniforms in support and solidarity with Gandhi, who was the most steadfast opponent of the British Empire, the English policeman.
Yeah.
And, within a day or two, the whole atmosphere began to change. Women refused to eat at home. So with that atmosphere, then these people came to Gandhi and they threw their weapons at his feet. He said, I've never seen a Sten gun until now. They threw their weapons at his feet and said, we can take the burden of any sin upon our shoulders, but not this. It won't be on our account that you die. And so the violence stopped. And when it stopped, then he said, it's God's work, not mine. You see, that's very interesting. Then what happened is that after that, some women came to him and said, we want to do puja, we want to do a ritual. And he said that you sell all the materials for this puja and you distribute the money to the poor. And then they said, what is your message? He said, my life is my message, nothing else. So it's after that he said, he was sitting in a group with people talking. It's after that fast that he said this, that good is self-existent, evil is not. Evil is like a parasite that lives around good. It will collapse of its own accord when the support given to it by good is withdrawn.
Well, it's a beautiful expression. Nevertheless, in 2024, we are facing war on a global scale. We are facing atrocities. We are watching evil people come to power. How can these words of Gandhi be of any use to us today?
I think they only serve to make us think. If we believe in the priority of goodness, and then we see evil only as a rupture in goodness, just as a lie is a rupture in truth, okay? There's no religion, no philosophy which hails untruth, which says we must live according to lies. We must tell lies all the time. So the truth always takes priority over the lie. And in that sense, light always takes priority over darkness. Light contains the darkness. The truth contains the lie. You know? So it's only when you make it, and many, as I said, it's not just Gandhi. There's many people. There's a famous Polish historian and philosopher, Leszek Kolakowski, who died a few years ago. He used to be a communist also. He's written extensively on these things. So he talks about the regime of the sacred. What does it mean? What is the sacred? You know? So therefore, this question of goodness and lies and truth and lies and falsehood and evil, these are very crucial questions for every civilization, every society. It's nothing new. Secondly, there are different approaches to it. And we have to answer your question. If we are awash with lies and evil, first thing we must note is that we are aware of it. Some of us are talking about all this going on around us as if it's an expression of evil. It alarms us. The very fact that it alarms us, regardless of what religion we belong to and regardless of what language or nation we belong to, it's a human question. It's not a cultural, national question. If it alarms us, then it proves that there is a problem here. At the very least, there's a problem. There are some people, I mean, even if we feel that the whole of the Palestine-Israel problem is going absolutely afire and mad, there are still people who are Israelis who are saying, we are ashamed that our government is doing this. If there are people within Nazi Germany who said, we are ashamed that our government is doing this, if there are people in any community who stand up and say, for my community to do this, I feel ashamed, I must stop it, that means that the concept of good and evil overrides communities and religious boundaries.
Yet these people are often in the minority, and so it's sometimes hard to see that, because the majority is following, is committed to just do as everybody says you should do, and then commit evil. Then, so the how can the minority be the proof that good prevails?
I think the opposite is the case. What is true is that there is apathy, and there is fear, and there is intimidation, and there is silence. People keep silent. There are some people who are silent because they are afraid of repercussions. There are the other people who are silent because they have divided loyalties and they are in doubt, they are anxious, they don't want to commit. And there are other people who are silent because they tolerate it and they say it's fine. So there are various qualities of silence, you see. And therefore, we must start with the presupposition that most people would prefer us not to be at war all the time. You know, most people would prefer it if this were not the case. All right. And then we have to think carefully as to why people are silent and what is happening. You have a very, very powerful mass media and mass propaganda machinery in all the countries. There's propaganda machinery, There is the misuse of state authority to intimidate critics. There is a closing off of sources of correct information. You can't trust any sources of information. And so we are living in a time when all the question of truth and being post-truth is being put forward even by academicians. Even academicians and intellectuals are talking as if there's no such thing as truth.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in daily life, they wouldn't function like that. What they say in the classroom is one thing. If they go out of the classroom and they get hit by a car or they fall very sick, then they won't start indulging in post-truth relativism. They'll either go to a doctor or pray or do something about it on the ground that this has actually happened. They won't pretend that, oh, it's post-truth world we are living in, so we don't know whether it happened or did not happen. You can't do without truth in your daily life. If you have a headache, you take a pill or you pray to Jesus, whatever you want to do, but you don't say, I don't have a headache. It's all a dream. So this illusion that everything is a dream and everything is an illusion, this is false. Because in order to say that everything is an illusion, in order to say that everybody is asleep, at least one person must be awake to notice that everybody else is asleep. So
yes.
This is a self-canceling argument. People may talk anything, but for various reasons, misinformation, disinformation, sentimental attachment to some wrongdoing, they want to carry on believing that because they're afraid of it, of admitting that what happened was wrong.
Nevertheless, in Buddhist thought and also I think in Hinduism as well, the idea of Maya, that everything is illusion, it's hard to match that with the idea that truth prevails and that there is a reality and that this reality is truth.
Yeah, well, the thing is that everything is Maya except for the person who noticed that everything is Maya.
Yes.
These are all self-canceling and absurdist arguments. So why do you need to tell everybody everything is Maya? Keep quiet. You see, in fact, we have to question even why God wanted to speak to us. God is pure bliss. Why should he even need to communicate his wishes to us in either Arabic or Sanskrit or Latin? Why didn't he communicate himself to us in Eskimos language? So these are all big questions. So I believe that theology and philosophy have the same root. The only thing is that when you go deeper into it, then you find differences of opinion as to some major philosophical questions. One question is, did creation come before goodness, or did goodness come before creation? In the Abrahamic traditions, and it's very interesting that all the children of Abraham have been fighting with each other for many hundreds of years. People who are followers of Abrahamic traditions, and by Abrahamic traditions, I mean Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, they're all part of a family. They have to ask themselves this question seriously, not as a polemic. I'm not in a polemical mood. I don't want to talk polemically and say you guys are bad or anything. But this is a problem because I was also brought up a Catholic. And my name is a Judaic name. It's one of the 12 tribes of Judea. So the point is that in the Abrahamic tradition, the prophetic tradition, God created the world and he saw that it was good. God said, let there be light, and there was light, and he saw that it is good. And all the things of creation he created and he saw. This is the first book of Moses. This is in the Old Testament. I've got a copy of my father's Bible, which he was presented in September 1939, the year the Second World War started. And he read it every day until his death. In that, the first book of Moses says God created and then he saw that it's good. So creation is not good. Creation comes first And then God then God sees that it is good, and it is written down. The Torah is itself sacred. It's the word of God. So the word is sacred, and it's written down, and God certifies that it is good. But in the Platonic Socratic tradition, the cosmos is good, and creation comes after that. And the goodness of the cosmos is visible to all of us. Anyone who can see and hear knows that the cosmos is good. It doesn't require the intercession of God to tell us, to certify that it is good. So this is one problem, a philosophical problem.
But since you quote the scriptures, how did Gandhi reflect on the scriptures, on the holy scriptures? Because if with a book in your hand, you say this is true, and with another book in your other hand, well, somebody else says this is true, and the fight, and it's going on in the Middle East right now. How do you think this can ever stop? Why is there no Gandhi-like figure arising there, telling nonviolence is the way?
You see, I think that's why Gandhi is quite a unique figure, because he recognized exactly the problem you're stating. He said, there are all these scriptures. He was asked this question also. In 1936, he was asked this question. There are so many different scriptures, and they all claim to possess the truth. And how will you deal with it? So there are practical issues, how he dealt with it, and this is theoretical answer, and I'll tell you both. The theoretical answer was that I never take the reported word of God literally. The word wishes of God come to us through a process of double distillation. These are his words. Double distillation. First, God communicates to his prophet, and then the prophet communicates to his disciples, and then the disciples tell us what they said. So we cannot really be sure as to what God's wishes are, because it is a process of double distillation. Therefore, then the journalist asked him, then who then is the judge? He tapped his chest and he said, I'm the judge. He didn't mean I'm the judge for everybody. He said, we are all the judges. We have the capacity. So he said, I am not dismissing reason. We must use our reason to figure this out.
Yes, that's what he called the inner voice, the conscience.
Yeah. Yes. It's the inner voice of conscience and reason. And reason, he said, but reason within limits. There are some places that reason cannot go. I believe he said, you must not misunderstand me. I believe that God exists. I have faith in God. But everything reportedly to be the wishes of God is something that I can't decide except by the use of my reason. So he spoke both of faith and reason. And he said, we have to decide, what is contained in all the texts. If something in the text goes against my reason, I will not accept it. Secondly, practically speaking, he tried to evolve a new method of coexistence based in his ashrams. So he would perform one kind of social experiment and practice within the ashrams, like the Phoenix Farm in South Africa or the various ashrams in India. So those ashrams were what the communists and all called the communes, you know. So they were places where people behaved in an appropriate manner, all right? And there was no discrimination. And whenever they prayed, they would not pray according to one particular faith. They would use general terms and language of faith, which would be appealed to everybody. And if anyone objected to their books being placed on a par with other books, he would simply place that book at a higher place and somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So he'd take the Quran and place it somewhere else so that Muslims would not feel bad. Yeah. So in this way, he would develop an attitude in which he said, you begin with friendship and affection and then go into doctrines. And he mentioned in that thing, this shows his intense knowledge and reading of all the scriptures. He said, he quoted the Bible. He said, above all, the letter killeth, the spirit giveth life. That is another way of saying, if we are dogmatic, we'll kill ourselves. But if you have the spirit of friendship, it will persist.
But nevertheless, the question is, why is it that nonviolent resistance, apart from what happened in India, never really replaced war as a means to achieve a nationalist goal?
I don't think so. I think, you know, Martin Luther King said it long ago in the 1960s, he said the choice is no longer between violence and nonviolence, it's the choice is between nonviolence and non-existence. He said he became a follower of Mahatma Gandhi. His whole civil rights movement was based on nonviolence. The biggest nonviolent movement in Europe is something which everyone has forgotten about. Nobody talks about it. And that was the movement which actually ended the Cold War. It was European nuclear disarmament. It took place when Ronald Reagan was wanting to establish, put MX missiles in Europe. And then there were mass demonstrations all over Europe and in Germany and France, etc., who opposed the installation of MX missiles. And that huge, it was, I'm sure you know, with European nuclear disarmament, that movement led to the strengthening of the peace and reformist faction within the Soviet Communist Party. So Gorbachev basically became powerful only because there was a strong non-aligned, non-violent movement opposed to American missiles and American militarism in Europe. And so the reformists in the Soviet Union could say that, look, there's an equally powerful movement against American militarism in Europe. So that actually is the movement which led to the final end of the Cold War. It's a very huge achievement, and it could never have been done by gangs of people engaging in violence.
Okay, thank you for reminding that. But we all seem to have forgotten.
Yeah, now that's the question. That's the real issue. Why is it that when as huge a movement as the European nuclear disarmament, which accomplished as big a historical achievement as ending the Cold War virtually, why is it that such a movement is forgotten immediately? We don't talk about it. There were women in Britain, it's a Greenham Commons movement, where women encircled Greenham Commons, you know, airfield and so nuclear base and so on, and they said, we're not leaving. Yes. So this kind of thing has happened with very powerful movements. So we forget about it because the whole establishment, if we understand that the whole establishment is geared towards warfare and polemics, then you understand what happened to Julian Assange. You know, you're terrorizing the man for telling the truth. A person who tells the truth gets put in jail for years and years. And you have various founders of Facebook and Elon Musk and whatnot who propagate lies and propaganda. And, you know, they are hailed as messiahs. So if the establishment is invested in lies, propaganda, militarism, polemics, animosity, etc., they're making money out of it. But you see, if it's now a train wreck, well, Gandhi once used to say that if a man traveling in a train moving at 40 miles an hour suddenly develops an aversion to travel and jumps out of the train, he'll only succeed in killing himself. So you've developed a huge momentum, you know, of violence and so on. So that is something we can't control now unless the people come to their senses. After all, in Israel, if people really think that there's a final solution, this final solution is the term invented by Hitler. There's no final solution. The very least that people should have learned is that there are no final solutions. And by wiping out people and assassinating people, you're not going to do away with the problem. You'll in fact magnify the problem. That mount, I can't, sometimes I feel so dismayed at the number of people they've killed and the number of children have been traumatized and murdered. The figures are well into the tens of thousands, is much more than 40,000. It's probably close to 100,000.
Yeah, the Lancet said even 180,000.
Yes. So if this is the situation,
yes,
then see, what happens is that when people develop a vested interest in their own hatred, when they can't confront what they are doing, you can't convince anyone. You can, that's what That's why I realized the truth about Gandhi said, you have to touch people's hearts. Dogma and doctrines are not going to make any difference. You know, either people are touched in their hearts and they realize what is happening, or they are not, in which case nothing can be done. And that's why I gave a series of quotations, I gave a series of examples in that piece,
Yes.
saying how there are people, and love has no religion. One priest, these are priests who are helping Muslim refugees. So there was a great deal of love there. You see, in India, when India was partitioned, there was a great deal of violence, but there were also a great number of people who were helping their neighbors. You know, helping people of different faiths without knowing who they are.
Yes.
So all these instances show that there is a fund of human goodness. Actually, Gandhi said that if this evil and wrongdoing and warfare are the main aspects of our human nature, then we should have ceased to exist long ago. The very fact that we are still alive is proof of the fact that basically the power of the soul force and the force of love and friendship is much more powerful than the force of rupture. So if you start from that, then you can start the ball rolling. Now, what I find is that I have thought a lot about this Abrahamic situation of all the children of Abraham at each other's throats. I find, for instance, in all the commentary in the Western commentators and all, not a single one of them chooses to remind the readers that anti-Semitism was a Christian form of bigotry against the Jews, not a Muslim form of bigotry. Because anti-Semitism was going along for 6 centuries before Prophet Muhammad was even born. It's a Christian form of bigotry, especially in the Gospel according to Matthew, in which the Jews insisted on crucifying Christ. So this is a falsehood. In the Muslim tradition, the Jews are not responsible for the death of Christ. It's the Roman Empire, which is true. So it's a Christian form of bigotry, and all these op-ed writers, American or English or whatever, they should also, if they're honest, they should say that anti-Semitism existed long before Muslims even came as a religion. They never say that. So basically, now this is, Jesus Christ was a Palestinian Arab. Those days they used to refer to it as Canaan. So Canaan and Palestine are the same thing. Actually, the polytheists were the white guys. Italians and Greeks were the white guys. They were Europeans. They were the polytheists. The monotheists were the brown guys like me. Gandhi said in a speech in 1927 in Sri Lanka, he said Jesus and Muhammad were both Asiatics. Jesus has been made and sanitized into a white guy with brown hair in the
Yes,
Western world. Jesus looked nothing like that. He was a brown guy like us. So now what happened? The Bishop of Hippo, who's famously known as Saint Augustine. Saint Augustine is the most famous Christian theologian and philosopher. And he was writing in the 4th century AD. He was a Moroccan Berber. He was a Latin-speaking Moroccan Berber.
we
So
tend to
now, this is very fascinating for me. This Abrahamic tradition was born in Asia and Palestine. All right. And why has it become like this? You see, because in those, I can think of one or two things. I'm not thinking of religious reasons, because I'm not thinking in terms of explaining it by saying that my daddy is better than your daddy, which is what they're all saying. If God is not universal, he's not God. The very ordinary logical question that comes to mind and that I could ask anybody is, why is there a chosen people?
Okay.
If God has chosen you, what happens to the rest of us? Why are we also not God's children? Yeah, well, let me just go back a bit, rewind this a bit to Gandhi's notion of God is that there is one God and there are many paths, there are many cultural practices which think of God, but there is one God. And he used a very simple example for this when he used to go by boat between South Africa and India. Then sometimes there would be a storm and there would be a lot of danger and people would be frightened. And then he noticed that everybody was praying. So he presumed that the prayers must be going to the same address. So he said, if everybody's praying, they're praying to the same entity, you know. Yeah. So there is the religion of man, there's a religion of humanity, and there are many different ways of articulating that. There are different articulations of that. So his whole approach to God is God and the holy and the sacred is that it is one, it is something that unites, it's a human necessity. In fact, even Hegel said, religion is a human necessity. God is just the name of the good, all right? So therefore, there is a religion of humanity and there are many different faiths. The faiths are different, but the religion is the same, okay? So he starts from that premise. And then he tries to breach the gaps that we have created by that premise. You see? And so that's why India is an encyclopedia of these things, because we have so many different faiths and so many different castes, and Gandhi was attempting to bring them all together. And the simple common platform was that colonialism is evil. The British are not evil. This colonialism is an evil, and we should remain friends with them, but they should stop dominating us and enslaving us and exploiting us. So how to keep all the people together? That's why he spoke in a language which many people say is deceitful and all that. It's not that. He was just trying his best to keep people together. So that whenever he would have what is called pravachan, pravachan would be a religious discourses. The religious discourses of Gandhi were quite different. He would start by quoting all the different scriptures. He would quote from the Hindu scriptures and the Sikh scriptures. He would quote from the Quran. He would quote from the Bible and the Torah. So he would quote, and then when people would say that we don't want this, we don't want that, he said, what's wrong in it? Just listen to what the word is saying. Then decide. And then he would insist that there's nothing wrong with religion, there's something wrong with us. Of course, I believe he's over-optimistic, because within each religion you find some things which are not really acceptable. But you could find that in every religion. If Netanyahu is quoting the Old Testament and to justify what he's doing, people deny it, but then it's there. It's very clear he said it, you know. He's quoting things from the Holy Scriptures. Now, the Holy Scriptures are not all very easy reading. There are things there which are not very pleasant. There is a God of revenge. Vengeance is mine, I shall repay. Now, all these things may arise from the context of 2,000 years ago. The Mahabharata was also written, and Gandhi was questioned about this. He was very creative theologically. So he said, he was asked that the Mahabharata is a story of war, holy war and so on. He said those were times when people were fighting and so on. So that was the best way of expressing, putting forward a metaphorical allegory. He treated the Mahabharata and the Bhagavad Gita as allegories. Allegories which provide us access to truth. Okay, so he would say that the Mahabharata is not a story of just war theory. Mahabharata does not justify war. In fact, the essence of the Mahabharata is the futility of war. If you read the Mahabharata carefully, you will see it is the futility of war that is being talked of. And if you read the Bhagavad Gita carefully, you will see that it's a metaphor for the struggle going on within each human soul. It's not really an advocacy of warfare and violence.
Because you venture on, in the lecture you gave, you venture on that idea of the oceanic principle.
Yeah, oceanic circle.
Yes, yes. Whereas all the wars in the world actually can only be solved in your heart.
In?
In your own heart.
Yes, exactly. So he's saying that the struggle between good and evil is not a struggle between communities, one of which is good and the other of which is evil. And we know that from everyday life. That's what I mean. It's so glaringly obvious. We shouldn't even have to say that good and bad people can be found in every community, in every religion, in every nation. It's not that entire nations are defined by goodness and evil. So if we know, even the great universalistic movements of the world were based on the principle that there are good people who are capable of being reformed to our way of thinking. Now, whether our way of thinking is the proper way of thinking is a separate matter. But the philosophical issue is very clear. If I'm trying to convert you to my religion, obviously I don't think that you are beyond redemption. Otherwise, I wouldn't try to convert you. I
Yes.
must believe that there's a possibility that this man might become a better person by joining my camp. So that possibility, I am using the metaphor of the crack in the window, the crack in the doorway. If I can see a crack in the doorway, then I can look inside it and see that there is something in this man which makes it possible for him to become a convert to my religion. If there were no crack, there would be no talk. So the moment of preaching, the invitation, there's a gap between the moment of invitation and the moment of thought. I invite you, you think. Then you either join me or don't join me. But in the moment that you're thinking, you're a philosopher. This is the problem of the false prophet. This is exactly the question you posed to me earlier. There are so many different scriptures, and everybody says we are true. So this is where philosophy comes into the picture. After all, see, there are two ways of going about this distinction between revelation and reason. There's a famous philosopher called Leo Strauss, who also escaped from Nazi Germany. Not Levi Strauss, but Leo Strauss. He's seen as a conservative, ultra-right wing. I don't think he's anything of the sort. I think he's a very brilliant man. All right. Everybody has his limitations, and I have my own views on his, but that's not the issue. He basically invented this concept of Jerusalem versus Athens. Athens represents Socratic classical Greek philosophy. Jerusalem represents revelation. God speaking to man, the tablets. Moses, the Sinai, or for that matter, God speaking to Allah, speaking to Muhammad. So all these are revelation. Now, revelation is a form of knowledge. Technically speaking, for the person who is completely dogmatic about his religion, he will say even to reason about revelation is blasphemy. God has spoken, end of story. Okay, now we have the problem of the false prophet. This is a, anybody will say, was there only one prophet or were there several? Now you can say all the others were agents of the devil, but if you don't immediately say that they all are agents of the devil, then you will have to say, I have to distinguish between the different prophets. The moment that you reflect on the truthfulness or otherwise of the prophet's invitation, you are engaging in philosophy. So philosophy is, this is a brilliant line from Strauss. He says, men are always attracted by two kinds of charm. The charm of mathematics and everything that is associated with mathematics, and the charm of humble awe, which is everything that's associated with the religious belief and revelation. Philosophy is the gentle but firm refusal to succumb to either kind of charm. So now the point is that after all, if we are reasoning individuals, that reason has been given to us by God. Suppose I believe in God. God gave me this capacity to think and to speak. So if it's a God-made capacity, then it's not blasphemy for me to think about the different prophets. This is the fundamental problem: revelation or reason. Now, if once you become dogmatic and say revelation is all there is, then you cannot live with other human beings. You just can't.
Yes.
But if we are capable of seeing goodness in one another despite it, if the most dogmatic person will also admit that the fellow from that other religion, if the Sicilian fisherman, the father and son who saved 50 Libyan refugees on the ocean who were drowning, they saved them. And they said no human being can turn away. Now, all those refugees, whether they are Muslim or not, they would have to recognize that these two fellows were good men.
Yes.
And the same can be said for so many people. Those two Jesuit priests, the Berrigan brothers, who went to the draft office in America and tore up all the draft papers. And they said, "We are only burning paper, you're burning babies." And they attacked their own government and their own church. They said, "We challenge the Catholic Church and the Jewish establishment and the government. We
So
cannot sleep."
the idea of a chosen people is strongly rejected in what you just said, that there is.
Who says they're chosen by God? You are not God. So if you say that God has written the Bible is not a title deed to land. The Bible was written for faith. So there is no chosen people because that means the rest of us are not chosen and we have no option but to go to hell. That's not God. God cannot be jealous. To say God is a jealous God, I am a jealous God, and so it's a kind of spiritual apartheid. I see it as apartheid. If you say some people are by nature, just children are born into the religion, they don't choose it. They didn't choose. If you choose your religion, it's one thing. But children are born and brought up by the time they're in their teens and 20s, they have no choice but to remain in that religion. So you can't say that they're evil because they don't belong to my religion.
We were talking about Nazi period and a lot of things that are happening today. Me myself, I read a lot about history. Well, all eras of history interest me, but also about what happened in the 1930s, 1920s before. A lot of things I see around me in Germany, in Belgium, even what's happening in the Middle East. It reminds me of what happened in those days, and it makes me afraid that history will repeat itself. Nevertheless, we should never be afraid that will happen. Why is that?
See, I think that is one thing that I get from the Hindu scripture, Bhagavad Gita. There's a line in that which goes, Nishkam Karma Yog. Nishkam Karma Yog is the doctrine of selfless action, which means simply, you act not because you want the fruit of the action. You do what is right because it is the right thing to do.
That's what Václav Havel says about hope.
Yes.
You should have hope, not about the expectation that a good outcome will come, but because you cannot do anything else than
To do good.
Yes, cannot do anything else. So that's why I see Gandhi as a rebel in Albert Camus' sense. Albert Camus' book, The Rebel, makes a distinction between revolution, which is impelled by doctrine and promises a final solution, and the rebel, who is more immediate. He rebels against an immediate injustice, and he opposes humanity. Okay, the doctrinaire revolutionist has got a scheme for the liberation of humanity. His doctrine provides him evidence of that. The first line in The Rebel, which I'm teaching nowadays also, by the way, among many other books, including a book about Gandhi, the first line is there are crimes of passion and there are crimes of logic. The distinction between them is not so clear. The crimes of passion are crimes, as you can understand, when you're in a fury about something or the other. And the crimes of logic are the crimes according to a revolutionary doctrine. That's why the rebel so much infuriated Jean-Paul Sartre and caused the breakup of their friendship. Because Jean-Paul Sartre was still a Stalinist at that time. And Camus was attacking Stalinism as well as Nazism. So he, among all the scholars and philosophers I have read, among the whole phalanx of Europeans, only Camus and and Carl Jaspers.
I don't know that. I don't know Jaspers. I know Camus, and
Okay, Phil
Camus I
Camus and
admire.
Jaspers was a friend of Heidegger's also, but Jaspers had a Jewish wife, Gertrude, and Jaspers chose to remain in Germany through the Nazi era. He and his wife had a suicide pact. It's a remarkable courage. He remained there, and his friendship with Heidegger broke up, and he survived the war. He was very close. He became the bridge between Hannah Arendt and Heidegger because Hannah Arendt was very close to Jaspers. But Jaspers, later on, he was in the denazification committee. He wrote a report on Heidegger also, and their friendship broke up. But there's a philosopher living in Paris, a fellow called Marc Lilla, who has written a book called The Reckless Mind, when the first chapter is about Martin Heidegger, Hannah Arendt, and Karl Jaspers. So Jaspers has one of his last articles was about Gandhi. And Camus wrote about Gandhi. So these are the only two people who've chosen to mention. Everybody else, Gandhi doesn't exist. I have a feeling that Gandhi makes people very, very uncomfortable. They pick upon some of his faults, and you can find faults,
And
and then they try to ignore his message.
is that why you also feel that your ideas are being oppressed?
No, I don't want to compare myself to Gandhi at all. I don't feel that. My ideas are not. There are a lot of young people I'm talking to I engage with. I have no problem that way. What I have a problem with is the elder generation, my generation, who are so stuck in their preferred beliefs that they don't want to ask the questions, which as du it is their duty as intellectual to ask those questions.
You said that you are a man now in your eighth decade. You have you can look back on a rich life, I guess. And let's not talk about your legacy, but if you look at now, today, what do you feel? What is your urge today to
Okay, I'll go back to that speech that I made at Gandhi's birthday, where it's called the Oceanic Circle. So I'd go back to that Oceanic Circle, and where very clearly Gandhi said that parochialism is not what I believe in. My province extends to the boundaries of the country, and from there to the boundaries of the whole globe. So he was speaking as a person who joined himself to humanity. He said that it's a human being's belief in God, which I have adopted as my own. And at one point, he changed after a meeting with atheists in Europe in 1931. He said, before that, I used to say God is truth. Now I'm saying truth is God. And there are atheists who do good works. And as far as I'm concerned, they're also believers in something, in the good. So that is how he disposed of the problem. He said, you just have to do good works. That is what makes a person good, you know, even if he says he's an atheist. I had this experience myself with my Jesuit friends. We used to do collaborative projects against the communal hatred in India years and years ago. They used to invite me to speak to them, and I used to make very critical comments about the Inquisition and Catholicism. I was brought up a Catholic. They used to invite me, and then after that, I would say, "Look, I'm sorry. I've said things which will might upset you, and so on." They would smile and they would say, "There's no problem. You are doing God's work." So I find, therefore, this is one way of proceeding. You proceed by assuming the best rather than assuming the worst. You don't necessarily jump to the worst conclusion about another person. You try to enter into their way of thinking, you know, and you try to talk. Now, many of my students come to me and say, "You know, we have so many tensions within our family, our friends, people have such bad ideas. What should we do?" I said, you can't do anything. You can do something only when someone is prepared to listen to you. Because ideology is not reason and logic. Ideology is sentiment and emotion. You attach your sentiment and emotion to some dogma, and then you get infuriated with somebody. Actually, what's happening is a sentimental collision. It's got nothing to do with ideas. Ideologies are not soluble by reason and logic. It's a waste of time. So you try to get through to the individual. This is what he called heart unity.
One podcast about Gandhi said that it's not about nonviolence, it's about courage. That the whole of Gandhi's life was an invitation to be courageous.
Yes, it's true. He valued courage above everything else, and he said he believes in the nonviolence of the brave, not the nonviolence of the coward. So if you are truly courageous, then you face it. And if you're running away from violence and you're nonviolent only because you don't want to face it, face the violence, then there's no point. So that's what he believed in, the fundamental goodness of human beings. And he based his entire politics on that. People say he was a failure, but then you see they believe as if they talk as if Gandhi was the only actor in this great drama and this great tragedy. There were many political parties, there were various nasty people, even in his own party. People forget that Gandhi left the formal membership of the Congress Party as early as 1934. He wasn't even a paid-up member, although he was a moral authority. And the British were playing their kind of politics. There was a world war going on. So that's why I say that Gandhi was a rebel, not a revolutionary. He rebelled against the tidal wave of violence. And this is the worst period of violence in world history. He was a rebel against that. He said, I refuse to accept. That's pure Camus' concept of rebel, of the rebel. Purely Camus. That's why Camus really respected Gandhi. So he rebelled against the violence. He didn't rebel against it with a doctrine. He said, there's no doctrine of nonviolence. I'm not capable of writing a doctrine of nonviolence. Let professors write it. He says, this is something which one can only practice. There should be no Gandhism. You know, Nietzsche said this about Christ. He said, there's only one Christian and he died on the cross. I would say the same about Gandhi. There was only one Gandhian and he was shot dead on January 30th, 1948. Everybody who calls himself a Gandhian is befooling himself or others. What you can do is try to learn, try to emulate, fine. That's why I refuse to attach anybody's name to my name. I should take my responsibility for my own ideas. I don't want Marx and Hegel to be attached to my name. They stand on their own feet, I stand on my own feet.
I thank you very, very, very much for these brave, wise words. Thank you, Dilip. I sincerely hope that a lot of people will listen to our podcast and be inspired by what you said, like I was today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dimi. All the best.
All
All
the
the
best.
best.
And for our listeners, thank you for being with us today. Be on the lookout for the next episode of the podcast to restore your faith in humanity. While you're waiting for the next episode of our podcast, why don't you check our website, fondation-ghf.one? You will find a lot of information, interesting thoughts, and fascinating stories there.